Welcome to Haunted Hospitality, Southern Stories told by Spooky Gingers. I'm Robin.
And I'm Zoe.
And I have a story for you guys today, but first, Zoe, how's life?
Well, life's good. I've just been doing NaNoWriMo a lot recently.
Yeah.
I'm currently over 30k words, and today is the 12th, so I'm a little bit ahead of where I'm supposed to be.
You're pretty ahead. I mean, mm-hmm. You're more than halfway past, more than halfway through, like the dates.
Yeah, so
more than halfway on both counts.
I think by the end of the 15th, you have to be at 25K.
So you're more than halfway through, less than halfway. It's good. It's double good.
But also, the book is definitely going to be way more than 50K words, mm-hmm. just because...
I mean, most books are.
Yeah. So, last year, what I did was, once I got to 50K, I kind of just stopped, even though there was, 10 days left, because I had won at that mm-hmm. point. But I think this year, I'm going to continue anyways, because, honestly, it's not that hard for me to write when I'm using some time at work. Let's say I'm writing my lunch break, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's not that hard for me to put some time away for it. So I think I'll continue writing it, though, just to let you know about how close to not 50K words it will be.
That was a weird. How many the word count?
So
we're great today.
Yes, I'm at about 30K words,
mm-hmm.
and she hasn't even been introduced to the main issue of the book.
Okay. So what is it called? Slow burn, but plot slow burn?
So basically, she has to get married to this person.
Of course.
And I want it to be very fast because they meet for the first time in chapter 3, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going to have a pretty quick nuptials, uh-huh. right? And then after she marries him, uh-huh. that's when, the plot starts. But I'm just throwing in a little bit of, drama for right now to keep you interested until the plot gets there.
I was going to be like, well, what are you writing?
Yeah, no, there's, social drama as she tries to, figure out what she wants to do with her life.
I love a good social drama.
Me too. I just don't like writing dialogue, and when you write a high society fantasy book about high society, there's a lot of dialogue.
That should be your subtitle. It's title: a high society book about ... high society.
Yes, that's it. So Robin, how's your life?
So I'm reading, and you know this, because we have uh-huh. talked extensively about it. Uh-huh. I'm reading the high fantasy series, A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Yes.
Loving it. Thank you for pointing me in the direction of that book. I mean, I knew it existed, because I don't live under a rock.
Mm-hmm.
But you were like, no, it's good. And it just so is. I'm so enjoying reading it. I used to be one of those people that just read series after series after series, and I hadn't done that fast in a very long time, and it's just lovely to do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
For life, unless he does something horrible. I'm just midway through book two.
No, I think you're pretty safe. You're good.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. But no, that series is pretty good. I can't mm-hmm. wait until you get a little further in. Just a little bit. And I think you have to get to the beginning of book three.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I can be like, okay, so here's the dish. Here's this tea.
There's tea. Okay. I have two things to say. One of them is that I was talking to the cashier at the bookstore today, because I went in and I was like, I'm blazing through these books. I need the next book and then the little novella. And then I'm going to hold off on getting the book after that, because I saw a TikTok that recommended the full way to read the Sarah J. Maas universe.
Oh.
And it was read that one further out, after you read Throne of Glass. I don't know if I'm going to do all that.
Okay.
But I was just let me just not purchase it at the moment, because mm-hmm. I know it's the first one's kind of a trilogy, but it's not the end of the series.
Yeah. So it's a trilogy, and then there's the novella. Well, there's the novella,
fourth book.
And then novel. The fourth full book is from Nesta's point of view.
Which is the one you don't like. You don't like Nesta's character.
Well, no, her character I think is perfectly fine. I just...
That's a burn. No, I think she's perfectly fine.
I did drop it
halfway
through. I DNF'd the book.
Okay, that's why I didn't purchase it.
Yeah.
I might... I almost said something... a phrase I did not mean to say, so I'm going to retract it. I'm going to... I probably read the book, but I didn't want to purchase it today just in case, like, I also maybe needed, like... a break after the novella.
I read the first one, and then I owned the first one. I owned the second one, and then I rented the third one from the library. I rented the novella from the library, and then I rented the fourth one from the library, I couldn't get through it, and so I rented it again, and then I was like, nah, I give up.
I got that. I get that. So is it like a thing where, and don't tell me the answer, but you said in the beginning of the third book, you can like tell me the tea, the dish, the whatever. Yeah. So midway through, sorry guys, this is just spoilers for ACOTAR. Midway through the first book, it's like everything is flipped on its head. Everything you thought was going on.
By midway through, you mean like four-fifths of the way through, yes.
Four-fifths of the way through ACOTAR, you learn, oh shoot, I was like... looking at this through a carnival mirror kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is it a thing, and don't tell me the answer, where, like, at the end of this book, I'm like, oh, God, here's the huger picture that actually explains everything else.
Can I tell you the answer if the answer is no?
Yeah?
No.
Okay, thank you.
No. Okay, if I'm reading a series and every single book is from the point of view of a different character, to me, that makes sense. But for a book series... to be under one character and then suddenly switch to another character for a reason that I cannot name.
Yeah.
It makes me so mad.
So this isn't a book podcast, but I do have to ask you the question. What did you think about the Jacob POV switch in Breaking Dawn? Remember, it's Bella, and then Jacob has, like, pretty much a short novel's worth of space.
Does he really?
We have not heard from anybody. This is a first-person narrative. We haven't heard from anybody other than Bella, and then suddenly we're first-person in Jacob's mind, and we're all like, what?
I don't remember that.
It definitely happened.
So I typically don't mind if it's, like, a chapter or two. Like, there's one book that I read recently where, like, it was from the first-person point of view of the main character, but then she's, like, unconscious for a good bit, and then it changes to the male character's point of view.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's a reason,
because she's literally unconscious, and it makes more sense, I feel like, to write from his point of view than it is to try to exposit to her once she wakes up everything that happened, you know?
Yeah.
So, I typically don't mind things like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Honey. Get that piece of paper. Okay. Sorry, guys. Soup is being extra tonight.
She's being a lot. Lover. Okay, do you have a something-something for us?
I do have a something-something for us. And Robin, I have to tell you, I was struggling, okay, trying to find a something-something for today.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, I feel like I just did, like, three creature corners in a row. Like, I don't have any alcohol and it's Sunday, so I can't do a boozy drink. Like, I was struggling. And I found myself on the Appalachian...
For a second, I thought you were teeing up to have my something-something that we're recording later.
Oh. No, I found myself on the Appalachian Wikipedia page, like the Appalachian culture Wikipedia page, right?
Oh, nice. Sounds interesting.
And I saw something on it, and I was just like, no, but yes.
Okay.
So... this Something Southern is brought to you from Brasstown, North Carolina.
Okay.
So there's this convenience store in Brasstown called Clay's Corner. And in 1990, the owners Clay and Judy Logan had a few of their friends over at the convenience store. And they were celebrating the New Year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe it was 1989 to 1990, that New Year. Instead of 1990 to 1991, but I don't know if it actually
matters.
Taylor
Swift's first New Year, yeah.
Sure. So There was all about 20 people. They had some food and drinks, and they were just partying, you know, as one does. And this event would debut what would become a yearly tradition known as the Possum Drop.
Oh, God. Oh, God. I had absolutely no idea where you were going with this.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't see that. Okay. Possum drop, yes?
Yep. So when it got close to midnight, Clay mm-hmm. climbed onto the roof of the convenience store.
Like the ball drop.
But like the ball drop. But, so when it mm-hmm. got to midnight, he got onto the roof of the convenience store. And he had a ceramic opossum in a plexiglass pyramid on a rope.
Oh, wait, ceramic, and it was in the plexiglass pyramid?
Yes.
I'm so relieved this wasn't a real possum.
Oh, just you wait.
Oh, God.
So, what they did was he dangled the possum in the pyramid on a rope over the roof, and as the ball fell in New York City, he lowered the possum down to the ground.
Okay.
And right when it hit midnight, the possum hit the ground.
So this was a slow...
It was a slow drop.
Okay.
So everybody thought this was the most hilarious thing ever. So
I would too.
Clay decided he was going to ramp it up the next year. And a few days before New Year's, he went out and he caught himself a live opossum.
Uh-huh.
And he put it in a fishbowl.
What? They're bigger than that.
He put it in a fishbowl. And he climbed to the roof, and in front of his in front of his friends and family, which it was a little bit more than 20 people this year, he did it again. He slowly dropped the opossum. And I do want to say, like, it was slow, and when they let the, like, when it got to the ground at midnight, they did let it out afterwards. And so, like, it was unharmed as it scampered off into the woods.
So the possum was in the fishbowl when it was being let down?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I thought you just said, like, he kept it in a fishbowl for some days.
Oh, gotcha. No.
Okay.
It was probably in, like, some sort of, like, rat trap or something.
Oh, but okay, yeah.
So this became, like, a thing.
Yes.
And so over the years, it got huge, and it was always being held at Clay's Corner.
Uh-huh.
And they would, every year right before New Year's, they would capture an opossum
mm-hmm.
and they would put it in a fishbowl and lower it to the ground at the New Year. And people would gather to watch this opossum drop, and they incorporated a drag contest into the event.
Yes!
Where men would dress as drag women, drag queens, there it is, and they would compete for the title of Miss Possum Queen.
I'm loving this.
And, like, it had formal catering, bluegrass bands, a little souvenir shop that sold, like, t-shirts and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And they were, like, every year they would catch a new opossum and then, like, give it treats and let it go, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then in 2004, PETA called.
Yeah. This sounds about right for PETA.
And they threatened to sue Clay if he used a real opossum ever again.
Okay.
And so he's like, okay, I won't use a live opossum.
Mm-hmm.
So when he goes out hunting for his ball drop opossum the next year, he finds some roadkill.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Ah.
So okay. He puts the roadkill opossum into the fishbowl and he lowers it to the ground on New Year's.
And our people... there
still there.
Okay.
They're still competing for Miss Opossum Queen. They're like...
And here's the roadkill possum.
Yeah. Oh,
by the way, I cannot say opossum.
I know.
It's a possum. It's a possum.
It's opossum, though, because no, opossum is a different creature.
I can't... I grew up with possum.
So I do want to clarify, they call it the possum drop.
Okay.
And they call it Miss Possum Queen. But I'm saying opossum because that's what's technically correct.
Oh my God, you're no fun. Okay, okay. So they drop, I'm not saying opossum. So they are dropping now the roadkill. Is this forever?
Well, this continues until 2018 to 2019,
mm-hmm.
when the celebration is moved to Andrews, North Carolina, because Clay and Judy retired and they mm-hmm. sold the shop. So, like, they couldn't exactly be like, hey, I know we sold you this shop, but can we lower a dead opossum from your roof?
You must continue this tradition.
So, it got moved over to Andrews, North Carolina, and that's when they returned to using live opossums, because at this point, it was, like, other people, like, doing the event, mm-hmm. so they hadn't gotten the threats from PETA. Okay. And I think they didn't take PETA seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, unfortunately, in that year, the live opossum that they used, I think they dropped it too quickly.
No!
And it broke its leg, and the leg had to be amputated.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't know what happened after that, but I'm hoping somebody, like, took it in, you know?
Yeah, so it's just not, okay, sorry about your leg, released back into the wild. And opossum's like, what the hell was that?
Yeah. So PETA filed lawsuits, mm-hmm. and concerned locals were appealing to state officials, and the town elected to not continue the tradition.
Yeah, I mean, don't hurt the possum.
However,
okay.
Danny Welsh, a businessman in Tallapoosa, Georgia, refused to give up the tradition. So he now hosts the events in Georgia. And it includes much of the same as before, with vendors, souvenirs, live music, and fireworks. And they even have a kids drop at 9 p.m.
Wait, what drops?
Still in a possum. Children?
Okay, okay, okay.
No, it's just they do it at 9 p.m. and no, then
put
have
the child
fireworks.
In the bucket.
Yes.
And carefully lower it. It's just, if you're calling it the possum drop and then you call it the kids drop.
I get
you
it.
You see, okay.
I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they drop the opossum at 9 p.m. and then have fireworks, a little bit of fireworks, so that kids who can't stay up till midnight can see it.
Do they then drop the possum again?
So.
At midnight?
Yes, they do.
Is it the same possum?
Yes.
Poor possum.
Because this time they use a taxidermy opossum.
That's the best solution by far.
So.
It's not rotting.
No, it's not. It's
the roadkill was rotting.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Why didn't they do a taxidermy possum from the beginning? Then
because it was probably easier and cheaper to get a live or dead one.
I genuinely think if I'm talking about like convenience to my life, getting a taxidermy possum would be a lot easier than me in the woods. Trapping a live possum, keeping it, putting it in a fishbowl, and then lowering it from the roof of a convenience store. That's just me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it's really easy to catch an opossum, but...
But isn't easy to catch a possum, though.
Oh, my God. But anyway, so they use a taxidermy opossum, and they name him Spencer.
Oh, great.
And so he's in a ball, a wire ball, and it's wrapped in Christmas lights. And for most of the night, like, it's down and you can, like, take pictures with it and all of that. And then at 11:30, he's brought onto the top of the Kane Law Firm building. And then he is dropped slowly to the ground when the clock strikes midnight. And in the 2019 to 2020 event, mm-hmm. over 7,000 people attended.
This is amazing.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it still goes on.
I was gonna ask, well, because last thing you had data for was 2020, and
yeah.
that is the breaker of traditions.
Yes, it is.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I'm very interested in the possum drop.
You want to go to Tallapoosa, Georgia?
For the possum drop?
Yeah. Let's do it, Robin.
Heck yeah.
But yes, so that was... When I saw that, I'm sorry, I couldn't not bring that to your attention.
I'm really happy you did. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm almost mad that you found that before I did.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's just say no opossums or possums were hurt in the making of this podcast.
This podcast, yes. The possum drop, not so much.
Yeah, they literally did hurt one, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Anyway, do you have a story for us?
I do. I do. Okay. I'm taking you to a small unincorporated community for just a second in Texas.
Okay.
And it's either called Tellico or Tellico.
Okay.
Okay. So Clyde Barrow was born in, I'm going to go with Tellico, Texas on March 24th, 1909. It was a tiny unincorporated community.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see a population count, but I looked it up, but it only had one picture on Google Maps and it was of an empty field. So I'm assuming that there's not a lot of people who live there. But Clyde did for a second. And growing up, he and his family did not have a lot of money. This was 1909. He moved closer to Dallas with his family in the 1920s, probably around when he was a teenager. And Clyde grew up wanting to join the Navy. He was so excited about it that he got a tattoo already that said, like, USN for U.S. Navy on it.
Okay.
But unfortunately, when he was growing up, he had had some sort of disease, we don't exactly know what, that still seemed to give him negative health effects when he was older, so they actually didn't let him in. And after that, he turned to stealing and robbing as a young man.
Okay.
Just one didn't work out, go with the other one.
Yeah, that was some backup plan.
And this was from the encouragement of his brother, Buck. In 1926, when he was around 17, this was the first incident that we know of that he, like, really did something against the law. He rented a car and didn't bring it back in time, which is otherwise known as, like, stealing a car.
Okay.
And this was his first arrest. That was the first time he was arrested. He was in jail. And when he got out of prison, he continued doing these sorts of crimes and stuff. And keep in mind, again, his family didn't have a lot of money, and now we're entering into the Great Depression era. So a lot of people didn't have a lot of money. And in January 1930, we get to this point where I think you might start knowing what I'm talking about.
Okay.
In January 1930, he was 21 years old when he goes to a friend's house and he meets a 19-year-old waitress named Bonnie Parker.
Bonnie and Clyde!
Yes! Yes.
You know, when you said Clyde at first, I was like, oh, okay, Bonnie and Clyde. Not doing that because I don't know where they are. Probably Arizona.
I mean, they're not just in the South, but, like, they are in the South enough. So they qualify.
Yes.
So Bonnie Parker was born on October 1st, 1910 in Rowena, Texas. And honestly, a lot of their background seems pretty similar because Rowena is, again, a tiny unincorporated community. The population was well under 1,000. And like Clyde, she wound up moving closer to Dallas when she was growing up. She actually lived there from the time that she was around 4 years old because that's where her mom moved them when her father died.
Mm-hmm.
So like Clyde, her family was poor. And Bonnie, you know, went to school and stuff, but she dropped out before she turned 16 because she was marrying a boy named Roy Thornton. They married on September 25th, 1926. The two went to high school together, and shockingly, this marriage between two teenagers did not work out very well. I know you.
That goes against everything I've ever taught.
She was 15. You would think she was ready for this.
Yeah.
So, yeah. After a period of months, it doesn't seem like they were in a good place, and in 1929, so I guess sometime around 3 years after they got married, he went to prison for either murder or robbery. I saw one in one place, one in another place, and I saw one thing saying he was sentenced to 5 years, and I saw two places saying it was murder, one person saying it was robbery, but I feel like if it was just 5 years, maybe the robbery more than the murder? Anyway, he was sentenced for something, and this was essentially the end of their relationship, even though they were still married. She actually still wore the ring, but they were not together. She was not visiting him, all that kind of stuff. And just to give you a little bit of a depiction of her, she was incredibly slight as a young woman. Again, I saw one source saying 5'5", which is not short, but one source saying 5 foot tall, and there was a photo of her beside Clyde, who was actually pretty short too. He was 5'7", and she was like a head shorter than him. So I think she was 5 foot tall, and she was like 100 pounds.
Okay.
Very, very small person. And so Bonnie and Clyde, they meet.
They do.
January 1930, they meet at a friend's house, and they hit it off very instantly.
Okay.
And shortly thereafter, Clyde is arrested again, and he is sentenced to 14 years in prison for vehicle theft. And he is held, at least the beginning, in the McClellan County Jail in Waco, Texas. And it is clear from the jump that Bonnie is all in. Because she's like, okay, I know I did not do this with my husband. But I am going to visit this one in prison. And I am also going to aid and abet him, actually.
Awesome.
Yeah. So she visited him a lot, and then she gave him a gun. So she smuggled in a gun for him. And this is something that he used to escape prison successfully. But he was brought back. So he got out for a bit. Did or tried to go to Ohio and then was brought back. And during this time, just so you know, they are writing each other love letters with terms of endearment. And it is important that you know for later that Bonnie liked writing poetry.
Okay. Was Bonnie punished for bringing him a gun at all?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't know if, like, at what point they knew that she brought him a gun.
Yeah.
I have no idea, actually.
It might have been, like, 30 years later he was like, oh, yeah, I got out of that because my gal Bonnie. Except they don't live it to be 30 years later.
I was about to say, so no, that's actually not. That's actually not going to happen. At some point during this time, I don't know if it was before he escaped. I don't know if it was after he escaped. Because, again, I saw sources that said different things. It was kind of confusing. He was a prisoner at Eastham Prison Farm. Clyde, okay. During this time that he's in prison for vehicle theft. And this was a particularly brutal prison. Inmates were forced to do a lot of work that was really difficult. This is forced labor. And to get out of doing the forced labor, which, again, brutal conditions, it sounds like, Clyde got another prisoner to help him stage an accident where he cut off 1.5 of his own toes. Either he or the other guy did it. It was like his toes being cut off so that he didn't have to do the work while he was in the infirmary, like, recovering.
That is a trick that you can only play up to, five more times?
Well, like, it said, like, one toe and then part of another toe. So I think if you, like, it depends on how much of the other toe is how much the half works out. Actually, no, that's going to bother me. It's more than five, but I don't know how many more than five times you can do that.
Like, seven. Because, because you can do it, like, 7.5 times, but I don't think that 0.5 will really work.
Oh, you're so good at math.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. He could have done this 6.5 more times, really. But actually, and I wasn't going to get to this immediately, but his mom happened to be, like, working really hard to petition to get him out. Okay. And so he was released from prison a week after he did that.
Oh.
Yeah, I'd say that bargain did not work out too well for him.
Could have kept your toes, man.
Yeah, just like for a week of, but I mean, like, hard labor, so I get it in the long term, but like just a week. Poor guy.
Yeah,
well, not really poor guy, he does a lot of horrible things.
And it's also like one of those things where it's like it's so much easier to withstand certain conditions if there's a timer on it, like if I know that I'm only going to be in a really, really hot area for like 30 minutes. It's so much easier to withstand it rather than knowing you're going to be here until this thing is done and you have no idea how long it'll take.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I just think like what he did speaks to the desperation of what he was feeling. Because like it's not a light thing
to cut off a toe.
No, and apparently like it affected him later. And I saw one thing saying like that he couldn't, because they do a lot of driving because they are on the road and stuff. So one thing saying like he really couldn't drive with a shoe on because of, I don't exactly know how that all works out, but okay. So like it really did affect him and like bring him pain, it sounds like, or at least off balance. It brought him something that he had to deal with for the rest of his life. While he was in prison though, he was assaulted by a man named Ed Crowder, who was a prisoner there as well, but had special privileges because he was looking after the building. And according to a blog post on the Library of Congress's website, it says, he looked after the building. He was, quote, keeping the peace, which I assume means that he has a certain amount of authority over the other prisoners. And it really sounds like he was abusing it. Honestly, I didn't see this until after I had finished, like, all my big sources and stuff. But I was just looking to check one thing. And I saw that it looks like Ed probably sexually assaulted him, too. Yeah. So after that, Clyde killed him. This was his first person he had ever killed, and another inmate confessed to doing it in order to protect Clyde, because this inmate was already in there for life in prison.
Okay.
Whereas Clyde was only in there for 14 years, and it turned out much sooner, because he got out in February of 1932.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He got out, but he was not on the straight and narrow, and neither was Bonnie. This really is ride or die.
Yeah.
This whole thing, actually, that might be the name of the episode. Like, I mean, it literally is ride or die, or ride and die.
Isn't that where the term came from?
Is it?
I don't know.
I didn't see. Maybe. If it applies to anybody, it applies to them. It really does.
Yeah.
So together they formed what was known as the Barrow Gang. So ooh. Clyde Barrow. And this group took to the road.
Sorry, I didn't realize that was his last name.
You just thought the name Barrow was like mystique.
I don't know. I was like barrels.
No, Barrow. The Barrow Gang.
Ooh.
Yeah, they just rode around in a car with a casket of whiskey up at the top.
Oh, I was thinking more like Donkey Kong, but that works too.
No. The Barrow Gang was a group that took to the road, robbing small businesses like gas stations, restaurants, and banks, so not any really huge, huge heists at any one time. And again, this is happening during the Depression, so like, if nobody has a lot of money and you're attacking small businesses, then you're really like taking people's livelihoods in a really just bad way.
Mm-hmm.
And in a Dallas News article by Brian Anderson, historian Ken Holmes is quoted, and he like just says it very succinctly, quote, "Most of the money they stole came from people who didn't have much, mom and pop stores and gas stations." So you're really, because I saw on a Britannica Encyclopedia article that it was saying that, from what they said, I inferred they were saying that a lot of people maybe looked them in a certain way during the Depression of like interest, because there was people who robbed banks, like, because people did not trust banks during that time. Mm-hmm. It was like a little bit like it said, quote, Robin Hood kind of thought. But like they are stealing from banks, but it's like small time banks too. And it's like you're stealing. It's not Robin Hood.
No.
You're taking from the poor.
But they were heavily romanticized.
So much so.
Yeah.
So much so. So, okay. Briefly, who's in the Barrow Gang? You tell me, Zoe.
Who's in the Barrow?
I realized I put it as a question.
Who's in the Barrow?
Who's in the Barrow? So, who's in the Barrow? Raymond Hamilton. He is there for several months, and he is the first main member of the Barrow Gang other than Bonnie and Clyde.
Okay.
He had to leave, though, and was convicted on robbery and, it said killing charges. I'm assuming that meant murder, but anyway, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to 263 years in prison.
That's a lot of years.
Yeah, so he had to leave early.
Oh, guys, my mom's calling. I gotta go. So,
then it was William Daniel Jones who came in after Raymond, and he was a teenager. Then there was also Clyde's brother and sister-in-law, so his brother Buck and his sister-in-law Blanche. They joined in March 1933, and I don't know the backstory here, but they joined because Buck was just released from prison because the governor pardoned him.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then there was also a guy that joined toward the end named Henry Methvin. And I think that there were some other people mentioned, but this is the main group.
Methvin?
Methvin. Meth? V-I-N.
So Methwine. Because Vin means wine in French. His name is Methwine.
Henry Methwine, yes. So during this time, they're going from place to place. They will steal a car, drive it across states, abandon it, steal the same car, drive it, abandon it, and on and on and on. They are living out of the cars, they are sleeping in them, and they are washing themselves in creeks.
Okay. Not very glamorous for bank robbers.
No, not very glamorous. And their ultimate goal, it seems, or at least a big goal, to get enough resources from stealing from people to go to that bad prison he was at, Eastham State Farm,
yeah,
prison, Eastham Prison Farm, and to get those prisoners out,
all of them,
or at least to get some prisoners out.
Okay,
so that's at least one of the reasons that they're doing all this. So Bonnie and Clyde ultimately spend 21 months working together on a cross-country crime spree. They are traveling primarily in Missouri, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas, and they don't just rob people. They don't just steal cars. They also take hostages. Clyde in particular would often see a police officer, kidnap them, drive a long way, and then let them out.
Oh
yeah. It's kind of like he's like playing with their heads.
Yeah.
And this is like the worst of all, they are actually serial killers. I mean, like, legitimately serial killers. So It's believed they killed 13 people in total, most of whom were law enforcement personnel, though there were, like, at least three or four other people as mm-hmm. well mixed in there. So an article about Bonnie and Clyde on the FBI website lists Clyde's accused crimes, because Clyde was the one who got the charges for the most part. Quote, according to that article, says, quote, Clyde allegedly murdered a man at Hillsborough, Texas, committed robberies at Lufkin in Dallas, Texas, murdered one sheriff, and wounded another in Stringtown, Oklahoma, kidnapped a deputy at Carlsbad, New Mexico, stole an automobile at Victoria, Texas, attempted to murder a deputy at Wharton, Texas, committed murder and robbery at Abilene and Sherman, Texas, committed murder at Dallas, Texas, abducted a sheriff and the chief of police at Wellington, Texas, and committed murder at Joplin in Columbia, Missouri. And I don't even know if that's, like, the conclusive
right.
thing. It's just, they were kind of everywhere, it almost sounds like.
Yeah.
And really just attacking people all over the place in a very condensed period of time. 21 months is actually not that long.
No.
Yeah, they're kind of, like, on a mission, but the mission is not, like, it's a really, like, horrible mission.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I understand wanting to be able to, like, free your friends, but, like, murdering people to be able to do that.
Yes, that's where, like, that's where we draw the line.
Just by my moral code, I think I would be comfortable saying that's a bad thing to do.
Exactly. It's a bad thing to do. And so, okay, they clearly had it out for law enforcement personnel, but like I said, they also killed others, including a store owner, a butcher, and a lumber salesman. And by they, like, sometimes it's not necessarily Bonnie and Clyde or even just Bonnie or Clyde. Like, this is the Barrow Gang, but Bonnie and Clyde were, like, the core. These are the people who are always there, yeah. You know? So they were in Hillsborough at a store one night, and a couple members of the Barrow Gang, who I assumed when I read it were Bonnie and Clyde, but, you know, you know, I'm sure, said they wanted to buy some guitar strings, and the store owner was making change for them, and they robbed him and killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, a person's just working to help you. And eventually, Clyde would be charged with multiple murders, and Bonnie was charged with, according to Evening Tribune, and this quote is from the article, they're not quoting the charge, but it says, quote, active participation in the gunplay.
Okay.
But that same article reiterates a few times that people think that, like, oh, she was, like, with him shooting, you know, like she was there doing it. It's just that it doesn't seem like she was charged in it. And I think that might be because maybe they just don't think
a woman
would do it. This is not a moment for feminism.
Ladies, you can kill people too.
Please, no. No, you
that
actually
was
can't.
For legal reasons, that was a joke.
So Bonnie and Clyde first became famous probably because they took photos of themselves.
Oh.
So they took photos of themselves. Like, there's one, like, where they're kissing. There's one where they're posing with guns. And they were in a shootout, one of many, with police, where I guess, like, they left the car or something, and people found these negatives and they developed them. And so that made its way into all these newspapers.
Mm.
And it's like, that's how they became so well known. Cause it's like, who are these people? Because clearly, like, with the way they were posing, I think the way people think of Bonnie and Clyde now is the way they were thinking of themselves.
Yeah,
for sure. Like, I feel like, from those photos, and this is just me assuming, that they were romanticizing it themselves.
Yeah.
So here's a photo. This one is published in the Frontier newspaper in 1933. This one is of Bonnie. She is posing in a black dress with, like, one knee up on something, a rock, a car hood or something, and she has, like, a pistol at her hip, and she's posed, like, I can tell she thinks she's posing very cool.
Yeah,
but really it's quite an awkward pose.
And I think she has, like, a cigar in her mouth.
I was trying to figure out, oh, you know, that is the cigar. I just thought, I was like, okay, it's weird, but maybe it's a shadow, but you're right, that is a cigar. And there's another one I wanted to show you, and this one was from I found it on the PBS American Experience website. In it, she is posing with Clyde, and it's like she is aiming a rifle or a shotgun, I don't know how to tell the difference, at his chest, and, like, at point blank range, and, like, poking his chest. And they're both, like, dressed up, by the way. They're both dressed up. And one, Bad gun safety.
Yeah.
Horrible. You don't aim a gun at anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But to, like, see what I mean about how they're kind of romanticizing it?
Yeah.
They took these photos.
And it's just so awkward. Like, her posing is very awkward. He has a cigar in his hand. And I think she's reaching for the gun in his, like, he has a holster under his jacket.
Oh, wait,
I think she's
what...
reaching for it instead of poking him.
Oh, you're totally right. Okay, that makes a lot more sense, too.
But it's still just, like, awkward. Like, the way she's holding herself, it's just, like, she's overly posing in both photos.
She actually is pretty overly posing in both of these photos. I don't think it helps. And, like, I'm not... She's in, like, this long sleeve kind of black dress, too, where, like, I think, like, it's almost easy to look, like, weird. I don't know exactly.
Like, it's like she's a very slight person, like you've said, and the outfit she's wearing is very form-fitting, and then she's also trying to make herself look really big, and so it has this... And
it's
also,
an odd effect.
Yeah, like, with the photography at the time, it being black and white, and so you can't really see... shapes and values the right way. It just makes her look like Uncanny Valley-ish.
Oh, interesting to think of. You know, you don't really think of Uncanny Valley for like old time stuff, do you? Okay, good inference,
well,
Zoe.
Thank you.
So, okay. People are, I don't know at what point authorities are like, oh God, these are Bonnie and Clyde. I don't. But I can tell you when they started getting on the FBI's radar.
Okay.
So the FBI got involved in search for Bonnie and Clyde because of a Ford that Bonnie and Clyde stole in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, I think, and left in Jackson, Michigan in September 1932. So the FBI find this car, or it's found. Anyway, the FBI know about this car now, and authorities are looking into the whole thing, and then they become aware of a similar situation. So a different Ford, it always seemed to be Fords.
Because they're always found on the roadside dead.
Well, Clyde, actually, I heard, wrote a letter to Henry Ford being like, I really like your cars.
Okay.
So they stole a lot of Fords. And so they became aware of a different Ford that was stolen in Illinois and then abandoned in Pawhuska. So it's like, they stole one in Illinois, brought it to Pawhuska, abandoned it, stole a different Ford in Pawhuska, and then brought it to Michigan, abandoned it. And I assume that there was another Ford that was stolen in Michigan. But the FBI search this other car they become aware of. I think it's that one, and deduced that a man and a woman were the drivers from, like, what they found in there, and they also found a prescription bottle that they traced back to this one specific drugstore in Texas, and so they find out through the drugstore and stuff. They find out that it was supposed to be for Clyde's aunt, and they learned that Clyde, Bonnie, and one of Clyde's brothers, but I don't think it was Buck, had been to the aunt's house recently, and that Clyde's brother had gotten the prescription bottle from their cousin, so the aunt's son. And these three were definitively linked to the original stolen car found. So at this point, they have proof that these people transported, that's it, they transported a stolen car across state lines, which is the first, and I think potentially only, I'm not exactly sure how jurisdiction works, thing that the FBI had in their jurisdiction on these people.
Okay.
So on May 20th, 1933, the FBI put out a warrant for arrest for them for stealing the car and transporting across state lines. And now they're in on the search for them, too, because they have a reason to be now. So at this, onward from this, they have a lot of police shootouts. One of them was in July 1933. Buck, who is Clyde's brother, was badly injured from a previous shootout in Missouri. And so the gang went to a wooded area in Dallas County, Iowa, to hide out while he recovered. And they stole another car while they were there so that he would have room, because it was like five of them at this point. It was Clyde, Bonnie, Buck, Blanche, and William, who was like the teenager.
Okay.
And so they got another car so that I guess Buck could spread out or something. And Clyde went into town and bought food and medical supplies. One man named Henry Nye was looking for blackberries.
Oh,
in this wooded area. And he saw their camp. And so I don't think he sees them there, because he gets closer and he sees items with blood on them, including a map and a shirt. And he is like suspicious about this. And so he brings another guy, John Love, up to look at it, too. And John Love is also suspicious about it.
He's not loving it.
John Love is not loving it.
Okay.
And he sees this group and he's like, I think this is the Barrow Gang, which shows you how well known they are by this point. So he contacts the sheriff and is like, the Barrow Gang are here. And the sheriff gets a group of 50 people together. Some of them are law enforcement. Some of them are just regular folks. And they bring their guns.
Oh my gosh.
And they, like, are they hiding? I don't know. They come up to confront these people, the gang, while they're eating breakfast. And they started shooting at them. Mm-hmm. They just start shooting at the gang. And the gang had previously stolen automatic weapons from the National Guard, as you do. And they used those against the group of people that were coming on.
Yeah.
And the group of people, the group of 50 people, because it was against, like, automatic weapons and stuff, they left in order to protect themselves.
Yeah.
But now Bonnie and Clyde and all of them are on the run. Everybody is injured except Blanche is not injured.
Okay.
And they all got into one car, Clyde driving, except Clyde had been shot in the shoulder and was not in a state to drive and drove them on top of a tree stump and the car got stuck. So they went into the other car, but that one had been shot too and it wouldn't turn on.
Okay.
So they left without a working car. They had to go on foot. But Buck couldn't run. And Blanche, it seems, stayed back with him. And also, so Bonnie, Clyde, and William are running, except Bonnie, like a month and a half ago or something, Clyde had been driving and they got into an accident that made battery acid spray all over her leg.
Ooh.
It ate at her skin, sometimes to the bone. And from that point on, like throughout her life, she kind of had difficulty walking.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an account where a family sees them that I'm about to get into in a second, but William is carrying her. Mm-hmm. And so it's unclear to me whether like she was shot and he was carrying her because she was injured in that shooting or because, well, we have to run and I have this kind of recent injury.
Mm-hmm.
So William is carrying her. Clyde, a family sees him walking through a cornfield toward them on their farm. It's a mother, her son, who was not a child, I don't know his age, and a farmhand. And so Clyde is walking toward him. He points a gun at them, and he didn't tell them this, but it was actually out of ammunition.
Okay. But I can see why he didn't tell them.
Just
that.
So you know, this is an empty threat. he said he needed their help, and then he whistled to signal to William to come closer with Bonnie. And because there's a fence separating. So I guess Clyde climbed over this fence into the farm, but William, it's not like they could just like chuck Bonnie over the fence. And also Clyde had like gotten his shoulder hit. So he said he needed their help to get Bonnie over the fence. So William like handed Bonnie to them over the fence. They did end up dropping Bonnie on accident.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Uh-huh. It's just like that moment is like a comedy of errors, kind of like a slapstick kind of. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
They dropped Bonnie. And then they get her, you know, over the fence and stuff. And William, Clyde was like, okay, I need your car. And they put him in the car. He was about to drive, but it was a different kind of car from what he had ever driven before. So, like, he needed a quick lesson.
Okay.
About how to drive it. Like, apparently the gears were confusing. And so then they're all in the car. This is, like, the family's only working car. And then he's like, okay, I'm going to prepare you for this in the future. And then they drive off.
Uh-huh.
Just, like, a weird experience for that family. A very weird experience. So Buck and Blanche are apprehended, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Buck has to go to the hospital and ends up dying several days later because of his injuries. And Blanche is arrested and sentenced to 10 years in prison. She served 6, but was released early, and as far as we know, was done with crime.
Okay.
Yeah. So, it is January 1934. This group has been robbing people for a long time. They finally go to Eastham Prison Farm in order to do that raid of it.
Okay.
And so, the prison should have known this was going to happen, because they were told about it twice.
Okay.
But they were like, apparently not worried about it. I don't know. But they did. It was kind of successful. It wasn't as big as I think Bonnie and Clyde probably thought it would be. So Clyde hid automatic pistols in a ditch for the prisoners, and the prisoners used them to kill 2 of the guards while they were escaping.
Mm.
And they did get five people out. One of them was Raymond, who was that guy who was sentenced to prison for 263 years. And another one was, I think another one was Henry Methvin, who joined them later, I think. So Clyde was nearby when the prisoners were escaping and shot a machine gun in the prisoners' wake to help them get out of there. So they got a few out. Most of the people ended up going back to prison or, like, being found and being brought back to prison. So it's not like this... My guess, they probably thought it'd be, like, a bigger thing.
Like a
or I read an article that said they probably thought it would be a bigger thing. Then on Easter Sunday, April 1st, 1934, and there's other things happening on in between, but these are, like, the ones I found more details on. Bonnie and Clyde and another fairly new gang member, this is Henry Methvin, were in Texas. Two officers, H.D. Murphy, who had been a patrolman for 6 months, and Edwin Brian Wheeler, who had been a highway patrolman for 4 years, saw their car and probably didn't realize it was them.
Mm-hmm.
It's thought that Edward and H.D. saw their car, pulled over, and went to see if they were having any car trouble, and that they were just shot really quickly. We don't actually officially know who in the gang did it, but there's an article on the Dallas News by Brian Anderson that interviewed the son of a deputy sheriff who had investigated the case. The son, Boots, said that his father told him that Bonnie and Clyde's families told him that Bonnie and Clyde told them.
Uh-huh.
This is really like a Seamus told Dean told Parvati moment.
Yeah.
That they were pulled over. So Bonnie and Clyde and Henry were pulled over wanting to see Raymond Hamilton because Clyde and him had beef at this point.
Okay.
And a little side story is that Raymond told officers that Clyde was the one who was wanting to do all the crime and that Raymond was just, according to the Evening Tribune, quote, followed along.
Mm.
And Clyde was so upset that he wrote a letter to officers saying that that wasn't true. And that he included his thumbprint, which they already had on file, to prove that it was really him sending the letter.
Wow.
So anyway, he apparently has beef with Raymond. I guess Raymond's nearby. They're waiting for Raymond or something. According to this, again, like, fifth-hand story, Bonnie was asleep in the back seat, and Clyde, like I said earlier, would often kidnap police officers, drive them far away, and let them out. But Henry was kind of new to the group, and he didn't know that that's something they did often. And so Clyde saw Edward and HD walking toward them, clearly like patrolmen, and told Henry, quote, let's take them.
Oh.
And Henry assumed that meant
take like, care kill them. Of them. Yeah.
Yes. So he started shooting, and Clyde did after he did. So, like, Clyde saw that he was starting to shoot and was like, okay,
this is what we're doing now.
This is what we're doing now. And again, it was Easter Sunday. Edward's wife was just 23, and she had gone to her parents' house to spend her Easter with them since he was working.
Mm.
She only found out what happened later that day when she came home to see the funeral director there, waiting for her to tell her what happened. Yes. I saw an interview with her. She seems like such a very strong person. This is, like, not connected, but it's kind of connected at the same time. She went on to, like, I think 6 years later or something similar. She married somebody else. She had kids. He passed away in 1950, and then she married somebody else. And it just the way she talked about, like, kind of grief and holding a place for, like, her first husband in her heart, while also, like, just kind of going on being, like, these things, like, are just a fact of her life, and she has to live her life. It was just a very... She's a very wise person. I just read it and I was like, oh wow, she's very like aware of herself and aware of what she needs, and you can tell like she's done a lot of processing.
Aww.
Yeah, she seemed like a very special person. So toward the end of their run, because we're kind of getting into 1934 by this point, a lot of the fellow gang members had been captured. Blanche William at one point, William in 1933 was arrested. Buck had passed. And Bonnie and Clyde were running out of their network of co-conspirators who could help them not be arrested. And so the FBI, again, could only charge them for transporting a car across the state. But they, at this point, knew exactly who Bonnie and Clyde were and were putting a lot of resources into finding them, plus local law enforcement were as well. So, or at least I think the FBI were putting a lot of resources in. In May 1923...
I feel like, unless things were different then than they are now, which is very, very, very possible.
Yeah.
I feel like just the fact that you've committed two crimes in, like, high state crimes
yeah.
in two different states that warrants the FBI wouldn't coming it, out of.
Because, like, you have the most wanted list.
And, yeah.
Like, wouldn't, not to bring, like, Ted Bundy into this, but, like, was he FBI most wanted? I don't actually know, but, like, I feel like the answer is probably yes.
I don't know, but I do know that, like, there have been people in the past who have killed in one state and then literally just transported the body over state lines, and they were...
I mean, yeah, that would yeah. count it, because then you're, like, in two different jurisdictions, so, like, the default would be federal, right?
Yeah.
I think.
I watch a lot of, like, Criminal Minds, and I feel like that's the case. If they're killing people in multiple states, then the FBI is allowed to charge them for that.
It would honestly probably be a very helpful, just, I think we wouldn't call it, like, something spooky, but just, like, a, here's the jurisdiction rules so that we have them going forward. It's, like, one of our little, like, intro something-somethings.
Our a something social...
We'll come up with a better name.
Yeah.
In May 1923, Bonnie gave her mom a poem because, like I said, she was writing poems. Yeah. Gave her mom a poem she had written about herself and Clyde, and it was called The Trail's End. And according to history.com, one stanza reads, "Someday they'll go down together and they'll bury them side by side. To a few, it'll be grief. To the law, a relief. But it's death for Bonnie and Clyde."
Ooh.
Yeah. I'm wondering, like, was she the first one to really call them Bonnie and Clyde?
Probably where it came from, that poem.
It might have been. So around that time that she'd given her mom the poem, sometime around there, authorities found out that Bonnie and Clyde were in or near New Orleans, which helped them narrow the search. And then they found out more specifically, they were hiding out near Black Lake in North Louisiana.
Okay.
And authorities found out the morning of May 23rd, I wrote 2024. That's not possible.
No, I don't think so, considering it's not 2024
1934? 1934. It's definitely 1934. That Bonnie and Clyde were going to be taking a highway in Bienville Parish in Louisiana. So a group of officers waited ahead of the car, hiding in the bushes.
Okay.
Bonnie and Clyde were going 85 miles an hour. The police came out of the bushes, yelled for them to stop, and Bonnie and Clyde reached for their guns instead, or I saw, like, they tried to get away.
Okay.
Either way, the police shot 167 times into the car, killing them.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. This is the final thing for them. So when they saw their bodies, Clyde and Bonnie were both holding guns. And afterward, according to an article in the Evening Star, the day they died, in the car, there were, quote, 3 army rifles, 2 sawed-off automatic shotguns, a machine gun, a dozen pistols, and large quantities of ammunition.
Oh, gosh.
They were just, like, packing in there.
Yeah.
After they died, their bodies remained in the car, which was towed to Arcadia, Louisiana. And there's a photo of a large group of people looking into the car when they were killed. You can see the bullet holes through the windshield. And here's, like, some things I found. So when she died, Bonnie still had her wedding ring on from her original marriage.
Oh, wow.
Of all things. A lot of people were taking things from the car, by the way. Like, when their bodies were put onto stretchers, loose change fell out of Clyde's pockets, and, like, a lot of people rushed to get those. It was, like, memento. Like,
yeah.
Memento is such a weird word, but, like, that is what it... Souvenirs. It was souvenirs.
It's like that one house where it was, like, a serial killer house or whatever, and so people, like, started taking the bricks from the house. It's just this weird, like, fascination of being...
Well, it makes me think of, like, Final Girl, that one really creepy Final Girl, like, kept souvenirs from everybody else's horrible experiences in that weird museum in our house.
Yeah, and apparently there was a community of people who kept things like that and found value in that.
Yeah, I don't like that.
No.
people would end up cutting Clyde's pants and selling the framed fragments. And I think the crowd, one, it's like, I mean, they were fascinated, I think, that, like, the story of Bonnie Clyde was ending right there all places. But it, like we were saying, it does put a very bad taste in my mouth, and it kind of makes me think of, like, when you're in, like, ye olden times when they would, like, hang somebody and you have that crowd. It's like, kind of, like, turns into a mob just, like, yelling at this person when they died.
Yeah.
Just, like,
gross.
Yeah. So the Evening Star published an article on May 23rd, 1934. This was the day they died. And the article does state, like, Bonnie's full name in the fourth subheadline, But the big all caps headline read, "Outlaw Barrow and Woman Slain as Speeding Auto Runs into Ambush." And again, this is not a moment for feminism.
If we kill people, we deserve to have our full names in the title.
This is not a moment for feminism, but I just read that. Because if you listen to this podcast a lot, you know that in these old newspapers, they, like, don't put women's names in there. And again, this one, if you get to the fourth headline, hers is in there. But I, Outlaw Barrow and Woman?
Woman?
When they knew her name. And again, not a moment for feminism. But I just, I saw that and I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Wow.
You've got to be kidding me. Now, in popular culture, they're a thing. In 1967, a movie came out with Bonnie and Clyde, which helped cement their fame. Bonnie was played by Faye Dunaway, and Clyde was played by Warren Beatty.
Those are names?
Those are names. Those are names. I only, like, vaguely know of Warren Beatty's name from, like, a little line in the show Frasier.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Many believe that this movie is why Bonnie and Clyde are so famous today. It allowed people to focus, like we were saying, on the romance rather than on the real human harm it caused. I have not seen it.
Wasn't there a 2012-2013 movie too about Bonnie and Clyde where Leonardo DiCaprio
was there? Was Clyde? Question, was there a
hold on.
I feel like I would know if it would be in my personal zeitgeist if Leonardo DiCaprio in 2012 did a movie like that.
Hold on.
We're thinking, and we're Googling. That's what we're doing. Well, Zoe's Googling. Okay, I'll look it up, too.
Okay, there was a Bonnie and Clyde movie in 2013, but it was not Leonardo DiCaprio. Oh, it was a show? It had Emily Hirsch?
I have absolutely no idea what you're saying.
Apparently, it was a Bonnie and Clyde miniseries. I just remember seeing ads for it.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that's not Leonardo DiCaprio at all. But yes, there was another relatively recent film about them.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So ultimately, the couple wanted to be buried together. We know they did. But they weren't because Bonnie's mother did not want her to be buried with Clyde.
Mm.
So they are separate. They're not that separate. It's like they're buried miles apart. And living relatives, though, in recent years have tried to get a court to let them move Bonnie to be with Clyde. But
okay.
I didn't see where that had happened.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's the story of Bonnie and Clyde.
Where does the... Maybe I'm thinking of a different ride or die couple, but I feel like I thought that they, like, tried to jump over a canyon.
So that's definitely Thelma and Louise.
Okay.
Which, okay, I'm glad you brought that up because there's... I think I linked Bonnie and Clyde and Thelma and Louise in my head until I saw the Thelma and Louise movie. Now, I think Thelma and Louise could have totally been modeled after Bonnie and Clyde because it's like two people on the run and they eventually are like on the run because they've committed crimes. However, I'm going to go ahead and say that Thelma and Louise, you're like rooting for the characters and I'm not rooting for Bonnie and Clyde because like you can see how they get into this situation and it's like... in Thelma and Louise, and it's like just it kind of catapults them.
Are they real people too?
No, characters, which also helps.
Yeah,
which also helps. But no, yeah, Thelma and Louise. Okay, just going into what I thought about the end of Thelma and Louise. Growing up, I was under the impression that I think I got the ending of Grease and the ending of Thelma and Louise confused because in Grease they drive the car into the sun.
Yes,
and Thelma and Louise they drive their car off the canyon, and so I was under the impression. That's it. That they drove off the canyon and that their car, like, it, like, had, like, a... It brought in, like, magic.
Uh-huh.
And, like, the car went up into the sky and that, like, they made it. And no, it's definitely a freeze frame of the car as it, like, starts to tip downward in the canyon. Like, they definitely die.
But it's an older movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's, like, Susan Sarandon and
That's
Gina...
That's another name.
Okay. But no, it's a great movie. But yeah, very similar
vibes
in how we think, in how people tend to think about Bonnie and Clyde, very similar vibes.
Okay.
But yeah, that's actually the story of Bonnie and Clyde.
Well, thank you, Robin. I learned things about somebody that I thought I kind of, like, it's one of those things where it's like there's a social awareness. Like, everybody knows the story of Bonnie and Clyde, but then it's like when you actually think about it, you're
like,
can
you tell me one thing about Bonnie and Clyde?
Exactly. It's like, they robbed banks.
I mean, like, you're not wrong.
No. But no, thank you, Robin. I am glad to have more information about this.
Ah, well. Thank you for listening. Everyone, if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, subscribe, review, tell a friend. Subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/hauntedhospitality. For just $3 a month, you get a new episode with us.
Yes, and it comes out on the 13th because we're spooky. Woo. The one that actually came out for November came out yesterday when this gets released, and Kari is on it.
Yes, we got Kari to join.
So if you want to go over there, you just have to hit and join our Patreon. But if you want to see Robin's horses, you can head over to hauntedhospitality.wordpress.com. And if you have your own spooky story, maybe you've met Bonnie and Clyde because you're very, very old, you can write to us at hauntedhospitalitypodcast@gmail.com, or you can slide into our DMs.
I'm 90 and I met them when I was a baby. Yeah, we are on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Haunted Hospitality. You can also find us on Twitter at Haunted Hosts. Hope to see you there.
Stay spooky!